Hello, everyone. This is Joshua Gilliland, one of the founding attorneys on The Legal Geeks. And with me is one of our guest bloggers, Thomas Harper. Thomas, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm ready to talk some monkey business here. And I promise to only use that pun another 17 or 18 times.
Stop monkeying around. So for those of you who haven't read Thomas, he's a JAG officer, active duty in the U.S. Army. He loves Star Wars. And we're going to come back to Star Wars in another recording. But we're going to talk about Kong Skull Island because there was all kinds of legal stuff in that I took notes while watching. And afterwards, I texted Thomas. So, Thomas,
did anyone... Now you took notes. Did anyone in the theater like elbow you as you're trying to jot down pen and paper in the middle of the movie?
No. I was a matinee, so
you had plenty of elbow room in the theater.
And what I do is, while the credits are rolling, waiting for the end credits scene, that's when I will like type stuff up and probably make notes. So that's how I roll, which makes me super fun on dates.
Everybody that's waiting for the King Kong end credits scene is disturbed by the light on your computer or phone.
Well, the lights came up in the theater I saw it in. So it was like, gotcha. I don't feel bad. But
I saw it in a very weird theater in San Antonio. I walked in, you know, I'm not from there. I was there last week and made a barter with my wife to be able to go see this without her. And for one, it's not stadium seating like 99.999% of theaters in America now. And that caught me off guard. And then I sat down and there were these recliner seats. So this is just an AMC theater, so not like some boutique. And my elbow hit this button and the whole thing, it was an electronic recliner. I like spilled popcorn all over it was not a good start to Skull Island, but I finally got things situated. I felt like I was Captain Picard sitting there on the bridge of the Enterprise trying to get situated. But
it's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing.
No, yeah. By the end of it, I'm sitting here kicked back watching Samuel Jackson, you know, scream at a monkey. It was good stuff.
And with that, since he is Army and you're Army, we should probably put in a couple disclaimers.
Yes. So, you know, I am a captain on active duty, but, you know, my comments here are not a DOD or Army endorsement of King Kong, not an endorsement of Skull Island. I can neither confirm nor deny that this $54 billion in proposed defense spending is an expenditure to go on an expedition to Skull Island. I have to keep silent about that. But generally, these are just my opinions on this stuff. So
I still want to know if we have a contingency plan for a Godzilla or a King Kong attack, because the Army has to prepare. They have to think of every contingency to defend the homeland.
Look, I can't talk about those things. I'd have to fly to California and you know, do violence if I revealed those secrets.
Oh, well, you know, so much for that privilege. Well, let's break down the issues in Skull Island. So first up, we have John Goodman's character go see a U.S. senator for funding.
Bill Randa, yeah.
Did that seem weird to you?
That was about the most bizarre point of the movie. I think normally most movies will kind of – I hate to go in this with like movies like this with any kind of knowledge because it kind of turns my head to the side. I'm like a dog that like doesn't quite understand something. But yeah, it was bizarre. I think, you know, for a U.S. senator to have any kind of direct authority, direct individual authority over, you know, a military unit, or much less an individual contract, I think would be a little, not even a little unusual, a lot unusual.
Yeah, I could get the Charlie Wilson's war experience and seeing a congressman, because at least that's where funding originates in our government.
Right.
And it would make sense if maybe the Secretary of Defense was called, but that was a little weird with a senator somehow being able to swing a military escort.
Yeah, and I kind of unpacked this and thought about two sort of issues that go along with this. I think the first would be, you've got Bill Randa, so John Goodman's character, and Houston Brooks, played by Corey Hawkins, who's his assistant or just partner. They represent the Monarch Corporation. I had to actually dust off my kaiju history here and didn't realize that the connection to Monarch goes all the way back to Godzilla. So the ship that they flash up, the USS Nautilus, that's got the huge claw marks, was actually the ship that discovered Godzilla. So this is clearly a non-governmental entity. So it's a contractor, as far as I can tell. And you know, feel free if you're a Godzilla mega fan to correct me. But so you've got a contractor here that's looking for an expenditure from the U.S. government to fund this research mission. And so, and then separate from that, the second issue would be the inclusion or the tasking of a military escort. And so both presented some problems to me, but I think you're right on with the business of this funding piece for the research mission itself.
I view Monarch as it's a secret government agency.
Okay, right.
Because that's the way it was portrayed, at least in Godzilla. And by Godzilla, which is 21st century, it's like international. So there's other countries at play. Being in the Cold War, it would make sense if it was just a U.S. op.
Right.
And I could see agencies having to go beg for money. Mm-hmm. But it was a little funky. And, you know, we'll talk about this in the review, but I thought they did that. I thought that was okay. You know, that somebody have to go hat in hand with like, hey, we need funding so that way we can keep in business doing the people's work.
Now, if Randa is representing a government agency, so if he is the head of Monarch and, you know, this business is a government expedition that needs a line item budget or a specific expenditure, there still may be issues, right? So I think our, civics class taught us all that the house controls the purse strings generally. And so I don't know that an individual senator would be able to green light it like they did. Obviously, they're not going to show. I mean, if they took 20 minutes to show the House of Representatives debating this mission in committee, all of us, including me, would have walked out of the theater and gotten a refund. But, it worked. But I think if they're considered a contractor, right, so if Randa is representing any kind of independent contractor, you've got some potential serious issues with the joint ethics regulation and just the general process of how governmental contracting works.
He had the line about Truman signing it, and which made me think that it wasn't a government contractor, that this is the super secret government organization that needed money.
Okay. And
I agree, watching a senator do the OBJ treatment, calling up congressmen and the secretary, and undersecretary of defense to go like, hey, Jim, we need to do this. Okay, Bill, we could, like, that would suck the fun out of it. So...
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said for elected officials all across government, to include myself, are as public service officials, no matter what your role is, you're in a position of public trust. Obviously, the level of that trust varies depending on your stature. A U.S. senator is going to be pretty high up the totem pole, and so along with that trust is intrinsic a trust to manage taxpayer dollars appropriately. And so I think one problem here, even if this is a government agency, you've got sort of a fly-by-night approval of a pretty serious and pretty dangerous mission, right? We don't know exactly how much this mission cost, but they're sending them out into uncharted territory in the Pacific. There's been no debate. There's been no consideration by really anybody. This is done in the hallway at, potentially the Capitol or the Senate office building, and just, greenlit in a matter of minutes. So I think as a taxpayer, Mr. Harper, as I sit here, would have some concerns about this, mission.
But it was the 70s, it was the Cold War, and I know some things were a little more fly-by-night back then. What, the Soviets are up to something? Well, hell, why didn't you say so? And
I love that that's the thing that triggers. He's like, you know, it's just going to be a matter of time before old Red gets his hands on this island. It's like, all right, now that you brought up Russia, we'll go ahead and send you whatever it costs.
Those were the good old days when we could go like, hey, look, there's a sunken Russian submarine. Well, hell, let's go get Howard Hughes, the Glomar Explorer, and the HMB-1, and let's go crack that baby open. Like, that was the perk of the Cold War. Stuff like that. We could go to the moon. Let's do it.
Unlimited funding is just cash shooting out of his sleeves there.
Yeah, not anymore. Not anymore.
Yeah, but it is interesting. So the contracting people. I mean, if you look at this through the lens of let's set aside for a moment that Monarch is a clandestine government organization, and just kind of picture it through the lens of a government contractor, there are issues there, right? So even if a subcontractor is involved, like Monarch hires on a subcontractor to do geological surveying or heck, even, any kind of defense or any kind of job that they can't do themselves, there are some serious problems with the way that went about. Government contracting, like a lot of contracting business, there's a very rigid bid process. There's a structure to all of this stuff. And for, if you take John Goodman's character as, a contractor, there's a big problem with him going direct to a government official like that. Government employees can't solicit any, they can meet one-on-one with contractors. They can't solicit bids. They can't give any kind of impression to others that they're favoring that contractor. And so this sort of meeting where, you've got the contractor bringing a mission to the government, not the other way around, and the contractor saying, hey, just give this to us. Don't worry about putting it out there through the normal bid process to other contractors. That's a problem. That's it would be a pretty serious violation of the normal contracting process, not to mention the lack of oversight that's there.
Exactly. Well, let's get into the other big issue. Is Kong an endangered species? And so let's crack open the Endangered Species Act, which defines endangered versus threatened. So
I just picture the picture in my head that as you crack open the endangered species, like some butterflies fly out, some dust wafts up just very gently, rays of sunlight come down, and that's just the picture in my head I get of this act.
That's probably closer to the truth with the current funding, but that's not important right now. So a species is endangered if it is in danger of extinction throughout all or a significant portion of its range. Mm-hmm. And a species is threatened if it is likely to become an endangered species within the foreseeable future throughout all or a significant portion of its range. And a species can be considered endangered because of a natural or man-made factors affecting its continued existence. Well, on the natural side of things, it's just Kong. There's no Lady Kong running around, so that's going to make breeding really hard.
They're all bones in that one part of the island. Reminded me of Lion King, like the elephant graveyard.
Which did have a triceratops in addition to a couple giant gorillas. So there's a lot there. So there's lots of good stuff there. Yeah. Also, dropping bombs where he lives, that definitely would be, an encroachment upon his range. So he might be king there, but, you drop a bomb on him, that's going to hurt the big guy.
Yeah, well, and I think, one of the criteria that's used in the ESA is, whether, large portion of the species' vital habitat has been degraded or destroyed. And so, as you're dropping, Samuel Jackson is busy bombing the hell out of this island. While the island's certainly not going to sink into the ocean anytime soon, I think the act of – they're clearly disrupting – this underground, network of tunnels, caverns, whatever, and disrupting some other species, which are, seriously affecting Kong's environment. pissing him off too quite a bit.
But. Yeah, it's not environmentally friendly. There's got to be a better way to go out. So we need to see if the Earth is hollow. So we're going to go bomb it. That was the best plan? I mean, it works for the story.
Hey, it's 1973, right? That's how you get things done.
We're going to build a dam and flood the town. Who's with me? It's good old Eisenhower method of internal improvements of just make it happen.
Yeah. Now, here's a question though. So he may have the requisite qualifications to fit the list, but in order to actually be an endangered species, while you might meet the definition, I mean, there could be hundreds of animals, fish, plants out there that meet the definition, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Services actually have to, you know, take a look at the, you know, the data that's been presented. You know, in other words, you know, you can be a candidate. So I think Kong might be a good candidate for the ESA, but I think some governmental action would have to be taken. In other words, you don't just automatically get onto the list.
Well, if there's any attorneys who, you know, act at Fish and Game who want to weigh in, tweet us your response. So, because I'm sure they would go like, there's only one of them left. Now, one of the interesting thing is with the Hollow Earth and monsters are among us, are there other Kongs anyplace else on the planet? Any other remote islands? Any other ways that they could get around if they can travel underground?
Like a Kong paddling to in a very small boat to the other island to visit a lady Kong, potentially.
Possibly, you know, I hope that, you know, he has that happy ending because he's a big monkey. That's just
Kong Tinder. He just, you know, swipes left for.
Yeah, that would be a big app. Very specific app. Well, let's talk about after doing the bombing run and one helicopter is taken down by a flying tree and used as a projectile. And after that happens, all the helicopters discover Kong and decide to engage.
All hell breaks loose.
Was that a good plan?
Well, so the technical military term for what happened there would be called FUBAR. And if you don't know what that is, you can watch Saving Private Ryan and get a crash course in it. I won't define it here. But I think what you have there is a rapidly deteriorating tactical situation that necessitated Colonel Packard, so Samuel Jackson's character, to act. And the real question here is whether it was appropriate for the U.S. forces there to act in self-defense. And I think, you know, generally if we're talking about what that is, because I think, you know, folks have heard self-defense in a lot of context before, but militarily, unit commanders always, no matter what the rules of engagement are or the general law of war, they're always going to retain the inherent right and obligation to exercise unit self-defense. So unit self-defense would be individual self-defense is, hey, I'm personally threatened. So, you know, if I'm in that helicopter where the tree is being thrown at me, I'm defending myself from imminent death or serious bodily harm. Unit self-defense is going to be the other folks in that helicopter formation, Colonel Packard's ability to step in and actually, you know, take action to defend his forces. Now, that action has to be done in response to a couple things. You can't just have self-defense just because you feel like defending yourself or just because you want to pull the trigger, right? So it's got to be in response to a hostile act or demonstrated hostile intent. Now, those are two sort of terms of art. And just to unpack them a little bit for folks that may not be, you know, familiar with the terms. A hostile act is going to be, that's a pretty obvious thing. So that's the tree going through the helicopter. So calling his javelin, that redwood or whatever kind of trees grow on Skull Island, straight through that Huey. And a hostile act is going to be an attack or another use of force against U.S. forces or their property. It includes force directly, used directly to preclude or impede the mission or duties of U.S. forces. And so that what you have in Kong there is pretty clearly a hostile act. It's real world example. You get shot at, somebody raises a weapon toward, you know, in your direction or in the direction of your unit, an IED, an improvised explosive device, goes off near your folks. Those are all hostile acts. Hostile intent is going to be a little bit different. So this is, if you view it on a timeline, hostile intent is going to be a little bit to the left, or, you know, a little earlier than a hostile act. And that's going to be the threat of imminent use of force against U.S. forces and under the same parameters. And that's where it gets a little grayer. But I think here, pretty clearly, you're dealing with a hostile act.
And so in the civilian world, self-defense requires you can't be the aggressor. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Kong, you know, the army was dropping bombs on his range. You know, that could be considered an attack upon him, and that the hostile force is the U.S. military, and Kong is engaged in self-defense, which would make self-defense not a good argument for the U.S. because they technically bombed first.
This is true. I think the caveat that I would put on it is that that U.S. forces can be engaged in combat operations and still retain the right, even if they're acting aggressively, to engage in self-defense. So the example that I would give is if you've got a patrol that's out there, or take the helicopter patrol, Colonel Packard's folks in Kong. Say, you know, they get attacked, or they spot one of those giant spiders that attacks the folks sort of midway through the movie, and they're engaging that spider. And then, you know, so they're attacking something, and then another threat, you know, presents itself. So Kong, for example, they still have the right, even though they're attacking, to defend themselves against that attack. So in other words, in the military context, being the aggressor does not negate your ability to defend yourself, defend your unit, or potentially defend other allied forces.
Which I would still see problematic in this situation, but that's the wonderful thing about being lawyers.
Yeah, yeah.
So now let's get into the issue. Colonel Packard decides to engage Kong. So right now, no one else has seen a giant ape that's as tall as a building. There, right. You know, these are helicopters with the largest weapon would be a minigun.
And which is like having a BB gun against him, I guess.
Yeah. So, you know, that tactical situation, was that a dereliction of duty not to retreat?
So, I don't think so. I think Colonel Packard was an idiot, but being an idiot doesn't mean you're necessarily guilty of a crime there. Looking at the situation, and this is taking the law out of it for a second, it made sense to me for them to sort of fight back momentarily, but they need to get the hell out of there. And like, if it were me in command of those helicopters, return fire, you know, get your folks that are closest to the you know, big ape out of the immediate vicinity of his swinging arms and legs, and then rally on a different point and figure out what you're going to do next. Because what ended up happening is just this mess as they try to figure out, you know, on the fly, some tactic that's going to work against this gigantic monkey.
They lose the squadron.
Every single helicopter.
They lose the entire bloody squadron because they don't pull back. And I don't know how much of this was his like Vietnam response of, we abandoned the war, we didn't lose it. Mm-hmm. Even though I agree with him fully historically that we abandoned Vietnam, we didn't lose it, we gave up and declared defeat, we didn't finish the job. That should not have applied to Kong. It's like, this is a giant ape, it's not the North Vietnamese, we need to fall back. and figuring out what to do here.
So, you know, actually the a dereliction of duty, I mean, that's something that I think folks hear a lot in, you know, common language, movies, TV, that sort of thing. It is actually a statute. So the for those that are not familiar with it, the military has its own code of laws. The Uniform Code of Military Justice is what it's called, UCMJ for short. Within this, there are statutes, criminal, you know, punitive statutes, just like if you cracked open the U.S. code or the state code of your state and looked up particular crimes. A lot of these are military-specific crimes that relate to stuff that doesn't really have a comparison to a civilian crime. One of those is going to be dereliction of duty. It's just a reflection of the fact that, A, you know, military members carry out a variety of duties from, you know, mopping the floors in the morning to executing military or combat operations that can be done poorly and in some cases with consequences. And so one of the articles, one of the punitive articles within the UCMJ is actually dereliction of duty. And so what the standard is, and tort folks are going to, I guess, nerd out over it, but a person is actually derelict in the performance of their duties when that person willfully or negligently fails to perform their duties, or when that person performs them in a culpably inefficient manner. So that that kind of packs in a bunch of terms there. But, you know, willfully is obviously intentionally, so you're doing something knowingly and purposefully. Negligently, you got your duty of care. You're exercising a lack of degree of care that a reasonable person would expect under similar circumstances. And culpable inefficiency is an inefficiency that there's just no reasonable excuse. So, you know, what do you think in terms of those definitions? I mean, that's stuff, you know, we've sunk our teeth into since, I guess, you know, the days of law school or whatever, those definitions. How do you think Colonel Packard's actions stand up to those things, those definitions?
Me? Well, it's a mix. I would... Engaging Kong was a mistake. Mm-hmm. So I think that was, they should have fell back because we've never seen a giant gorilla before. And
what can he do?
Exactly. It's, we've never experienced this before. So we're going to press on with an unknown enemy and we don't know his capabilities. But if he's like a real gorilla, we could have some serious problems here. So, you also then factor in, at least in this world, this is the world where we have Godzilla.
Yeah.
And they had the Bikini Atoll experiment, which was apparently to kill the giant monster. Mm-hmm. So when you look at a nuclear weapon was used to try to kill Godzilla, and you have helicopters with miniguns, that doesn't bode well. It's like, well, the last time something like this happened, we used a nuke. Yeah. You guys had your little machine guns, which were just adorable, and it seemed to make him mad. So there's that. So,
yeah. Well, you've got a monkey the size of the Chrysler Building who just threw a tree through one of your helicopters like it was a pencil. We didn't mention this at the outset. Right now, my job is a criminal defense counsel. So when soldiers get accused of crimes, you know, they come to my office and get representation for free. And had poor Colonel Packard not been squashed under the giant thumb of or giant hand, I guess, paw of Kong, you know, if he came back and faced an allegation of this nature, dereliction of duty, I think I'd take his case. I think, you know, certainly his actions were willful. I mean, there's no, you know, I don't think that he was willfully derelict. I think you've got to judge him based on the totality of the circumstances. And I absolutely agree with you that Kong's, they had one demonstrated capability that they saw Kong do, which is chuck a tree like it was nothing, and it just, you know, lit through that helicopter like it was a piece of melted butter. But you know, I would argue, you know, if we're squaring off in court, that you know, he doesn't have a duty to retreat his you know, cause those forces to retreat. And, you know, his duty as a commander in that circumstance is, you know, first and foremost to engage and destroy the enemy. A close second, maybe tied for first, is going to be, you know, to protect his forces. But at the end of the day, you know, those soldiers are there to fight and win a battle. And so while you and I can disagree that, you know, hey, he kind of, you know, made a, what you could consider a fool's errand and really engaged in a risky maneuver. That thing, you know, I would say, you know, at least draw it in court in whatever way we could. That situation escalated pretty quickly. And under the circumstances, he did everything he could to try to meet the threat, engage him, you know, maybe a little bit foolishly with the kind of weaponry that they had on board. But by the time it became clear that they had no hope, all those helicopters were down.
Or I think after the first two went down, that would have been a great thing. Like, we need to back up. This escalated quickly. So let's break down the next issue, because you and I, we could slug that out, and it's weird. I'm the prosecutor this time. But the next issue would be, let's go retrieve our lost airmen.
Okay.
And which means, let's go cross the Valley of Death.
Yep.
With poisonous gas where the Skull Crushers like to hang out. And you got the guy who's been the POW or MIA saying, like,
Major Chapman. Yeah.
This is a bad freaking plan. What's your thought on that rescue?
So I think at its core, I take him as a client. We would not be submitting a plea for a dereliction of duty, for trying to go after the major in that instance. And this is one thing that bugged me. This is always something that'll, you know, it's just, if you know military rank, at the beginning of the movie, he refers, when the major comes into Samuel Jackson's office, he calls him captain. And then later on, they straighten it out. And I was just like, oh, continuity error. But in any event, I think his desire to link up with one of his officers who's clearly down and, you know, vulnerable is completely understandable. I do not think that that was a dereliction at all. I think where Colonel Packard gets in trouble is when it becomes clear that, you know, he is risking the lives of everybody, you know, risking the entire operation and their ability to actually get off the island to go get him. And especially that, I think we can all agree, his real motivation, he didn't give a damn about the major. I mean, maybe he did a little bit. He wanted the weapons off of the Sea Stallion helicopter. That's what they were really going after.
yeah, that was the next question, because I could get a rescue. I don't get the rescue when it's going to get everybody else killed.
Because
you could say, like, so here's the thing, Bob, if we come to get you, we're going to lose a bunch of people. And that kind of defeats the purpose of not leaving anyone behind, because we're going to lose like seven to save one.
Yeah.
Or everyone to save one. Why don't you just head north too, and we'll see you at the rendezvous point. Stay alive, buddy. Like, that would be.
I think that raises an interesting question, though, because I think you make a very good point about the Valley of Death, the old King Kong graveyard or elephant graveyard there. You know, they get ripped apart in that area, and at that point, Colonel Packard, it's pretty clear he's ignoring, you know, a lot of reasonable intelligence, a lot of reasonable arguments that you know, to do exactly what you're talking about, to regroup, you know, get the major to meet them at a rally point, you know, and go about the rescue in an alternate way. And so I think that's where he potentially gets into trouble with, you know, the standard of either, you know, potentially negligence or culpable inefficiency, where it's, you know, hey, the cost of your objective here is far too high.
Well, then you get the other factor of when they realize he's dead.
Yeah.
We're going to keep going to get the weapons. It's like, dude, how many people have to die because you're upset about how Vietnam ended?
Yeah, exactly. What is on that helicopter that could possibly in his mind, you know, change the outcome of what's going on. I mean, they had the, I got it, they had the little seismic charges, but, you know, to me, that was like, you remember those little TNT poppers you get around 4th of July where you just toss them down, they make a little pop? That's what I compared those little things to, you know, trying to hit King Kong. So they were woefully outgunned at that point, you know, no air support, nothing like that. And, you know, I think at that point it was pure vendetta for Packard.
It's pure vendetta. And we also have evidence of Kong not being a threat by then, because after meeting up with our MIA airmen for 28 years, going, Kong actually protects human life and everybody else, and he's a pretty okay guy. It's like, well, we should kill him anyway. It's like, dude, not helping. So when you factor that in, it's like, it's pure vendetta because you're still upset about Vietnam, and I get it. Like, that was throughout all of the 1980s and part of the Powell and Bush One doctrine when we went into Iraq the first time of overwhelming force, win, get the job done. I get that from a foreign policy's perspective, and I get it from an active duty military perspective for somebody who was there. Mm-hmm. But trying to apply that to the giant gorilla, and you realize it's not really the threat, so this is the wrong bad guy, this is a huge misunderstanding, and we need to, like, get the hell out.
Yeah, you wanted somebody to just, like, grab him by the face, like Billy Madison style, and be like, get out of here!
No, let's go make the giant monkey mad.
Yeah, we've got a rescue mission coming in a day, but let's go off on this side mission for, you know, 23 of those hours, and then we'll skip up to the rendezvous point.
Not only that, I mean, the photographer has a close encounter with Kong and doesn't tell anyone about it. Because she could go like, hey, that giant ape's pretty okay.
He was real nice.
He's not a bad boy. We're the bad boys. So we got to fix this.
Well, I think your point brings up a good segue to at what point. So we talk about this, you know, side mission, this rescue mission, you know, probably starting out as a lawful order. And, you know, you could probably stretch an argument that up to a point, the mission to get more weapons off of the Sea Stallion was a lawful order. I think you can make an argument for that. But I do think that, you know, probably sometime around that massacre in old, you know, King Kong graveyard, it becomes an unlawful order. And so, you know, I think one of the questions that's raised is like, what's the difference? So what's a lawful order and what's an unlawful order? It almost begs you to, like, define it, you know, with the word, like, well, a lawful order or an unlawful order is any order that is unlawful or doesn't follow the law. But interestingly, you know, if we're talking about the context of a court martial, so again, if Colonel Packard was to come back home, not get squished, and then immediately get court martialed for all his efforts, you know, this would be an issue at trial. So if he's accused of being derelict in his duties, you know, was the order that he gave to continue on this mission an unlawful one? And interestingly, you know, if his case were being tried before a military jury or a panel, as we call them, that's not an actual question that the panel gets to decide. So the jury is not going to decide the lawfulness of an order. It's not a separate element of an offense. It's actually determined by the military judge and is not even submitted to the members. And so the Army judiciary operates off of a Department of the Army pamphlet, DA PAM for short, 27-9. That's the military judge's bench book. You could probably use it to clobber somebody to death. It's so thick. But it is the instruction manual for judges, and it provides a lot of legal definitions for, you know, some of these terms of art. And so the difference that it, you know, kind of lays out for military judges that are considering this is that an order is illegal, and it gives an example, if it's unrelated to military duty or its sole purpose is to accomplish some private end, or it is arbitrary or unreasonable, and you know, the rest of it's not really applicable. But I think two of those kind of apply to Colonel Packard. So the sole purpose is to accomplish some private end, vendetta, right? I mean, that's how I see that. That's a problem for Colonel Packard.
Agreed. And looking at, Winthrop Military's Law and Precedents, second edition, reprinted in 1920. Now there's a nice quote that says, further, the order to constitute a defense must be a legal one. It must emulate from a proper officer, superior authorized to give it, and it must command a thing not in itself unlawful or prohibited by law. In other words, it must be an order which the inferior is bound to obey. And you don't have to follow unlawful orders, because that would be weird. And there's great, great cases that actually date back to Benedict Arnold and Aaron Burr getting into treason and rebellion and all that good stuff, where courts stated, it's repugnant to law to have to follow an illegal order. Mm-hmm. So when you look at, we just got slaughtered and we're trying to kill an endangered species, it's starting to look less legal big time because of the vendetta-ness of Packard.
And I think, that's half of it that would be damning for him at a court martial. The other half of it is this arbitrary and unreasonable standard. I don't think you could say, his order to try to, get the weapons and engage him is totally arbitrary, but I think it is unreasonable. And if I'm, put back on my government hat and, as a prosecutor, I'm going to argue that the moment that they got slaughtered in that, in the King Kong graveyard, we'll hashtag that and, make a trademark out of it. But the moment that they get slaughtered and it's clear that this is just a fool's errand, I think his order in the face of, all the odds that they faced, in addition to the fact that they were endangering the entire rescue operation, for his personal vendetta, I think it becomes unreasonable. And I think, a judge is going to see that sort of thing. And I don't think that turns out well for Colonel Packard.
Agreed. Which then brings us to the fight with Kong, where they actually do, help wear him down because of the giant skull crawler. And we do have one of the airmen turn his weapon on his colonel.
Yep.
Thoughts on dun, him? Dun, dun. It was like, it's, personally, I agreed with that. It's like
any man willing to... Any man willing to raise a weapon at Samuel L. Jackson is quite ballsy, in my opinion. But that aside, he's got some problems too. I can't remember if he survived or not. That may be a moot point as well, just like Colonel Packard.
I'm pretty sure he did.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll get him into the Trial Defense Service office. I'll consult him for defense on his incoming court-martial charges here next week. I think his biggest – oh, go ahead.
No, go for it.
So I think his biggest problem comes with, the section of the UCMJ that deals with not just – like a very specialized type of disobedience, and that is really the most dangerous type of disobedience, which is like mutiny. And so the UCMJ deals with mutiny in a variety of ways – because it can come in a variety of forms, but mutiny by creating violence or a disturbance. So under Article 94 of the UCMJ. So think when I say article, think of that as like the statute number, right? That crime, is pretty straightforward in terms of the elements. So that the accused created violence or a disturbance by, a particular manner. So in this case, it would be, raising his weapon, his loaded weapon at that, on Colonel Packard, and that the accused created this violence with the intent to usurp or override lawful military authority. So two elements. Those are the only two elements that the government has to prove. Violence is defined as the exertion of physical force. Disturbance is defined as the interruption or interference with a state of peace or order. And usurp is just defined as the means to seize and to hold by force without right. So I think the government's got a good case that, look, you raised a loaded weapon. He's probably got a round chambered in that weapon, given the fact that they've been in, in active combat on this island. And he's raising it on his superior officer. So this guy, I can't remember his rank, but he's an enlisted soldier, probably like a private, you know, maybe a corporal or a sergeant. And he's raising it on a, you know, a full bird colonel in 06. That's a pretty big deal. And he's doing it in response to what? So Colonel Packard is trying to execute his orders to take out Kong. And, you know, I think the government's got a good case that he's raising his weapon to try to usurp that. You think he has a defense?
Oh, yeah. And so in my view, he's a lot like the helicopter gunner, Lawrence Colburn, who intervened at the My Lai massacre. Mm-hmm. Because at this point in time, you know, Colonel Packard's gone off the reservation. What they're trying to do is objectively wrong. He's gone full apocalypse now.
I was hoping you'd
full apocalypse now. Yeah. And you have, it's like the helicopter crew that turned their weapons on the U.S. soldiers at My Lai and said, enough of this. You're not killing any more civilians. And that's the way I looked at this. Now, he didn't have to fire on Packard, but but the other men go like, yeah, this is wrong. This is objectively wrong, which means we are dealing with unlawful orders because it's unlawful on its face, and we're not going to execute this giant ape unleashing all these other crazy monsters to come out and eat everybody else. So let's get the hell out of here. I think he did the right thing. I think they're historical precedent. Now, while I would not encourage anyone in the military to go like, hey, we got to save the sea turtles, so you turn your weapon on the Master Chief, that would be bad. Don't do that. But I think what happened here in the totality of the circumstances, I think that was the right call for you know, to turn his weapon on the colonel.
It's certainly high stakes. I mean, the mutiny carries the death penalty as a maximum punishment. I think his argument, again, maybe I'm just a defense hack here, but I would take his case. I think he's got a case that there's a defense sort of built into this crime. So, you know, you've got to, I think the second element is where I'm trying to key in on lawful military authority. So you're trying to usurp or override lawful military authority. And so the argument has got to be that Colonel Packard was not exercising lawful military authority at this point. And I think the way you get to that, at least in my mind, is that he has gone off the reservation, full apocalypse now at this point, to use your brilliant quote. And in doing so, he's done what you know we call divesting himself of military status or military authority. And so you typically see that sort of term used you know, in disrespect cases. So if I'm, you know, if I'm a superior officer to say a sergeant and I'm just acting totally inappropriately and then he acts in response to that, inappropriately, you know, I can divest myself of my superior status. So you don't get a blank check as Colonel Packard to just do whatever the hell you want. And so I think his argument at trial has got to be, look, you know, Colonel Packard went off the reservation. He divested himself. He's not lawful military authority. You know, I'm acting reasonably to try to stop an unlawful military order.
Glad you agree. So, and well said, my friend. Which brings us to the happy ending. We do have, you know, Hank Marlowe get home.
Yep.
And luckily for him, apparently his wife didn't remarry. So. That could have been super awkward.
See, I have to admit, as he was standing on the front porch and like rang the doorbell, I was like, "Oh, please don't end in a really like awful, ironic way."
Who's this dude? Yeah, it was.
It's like Will Ferrell answers the door. Step Brothers 2 starts.
That would have been brilliant, actually. But,
You gotta call me Dragon.
How much back pay would he get?
Oh man. So this is a really interesting thing. So I full disclosure, my wife is a captain and a JAG as well. And, she kind of helped me look into this piece because it's something I have not dealt with, but, It depends, but potentially a lot, and potentially his wife could have been actively receiving his pay and other benefits the entire time. So they could have all that, the house, all the lovely stuff that could have all been paid for with, you know, pay and whatnot that she was actively getting. The real key is going to be what his status was. So when I say status, you can be a prisoner of war, you can be considered missing in action, you can be considered killed in action. So soldiers that are designated as captive, missing, or missing in action, MIA, actually do get their pay and allowances. So pay is like your base pay. That's, you can Google military pay and see exactly what every rank has made on back into, I think, the 60s or 50s. And allowances are things like your housing allowance, you know, any kind of special pay, so combat pay, you know, jump pay for parachutists, that sort of thing. So in his case, he probably would have been getting some sort of special flight pay, potentially, I don't know if they had it in World War II, but potentially hostile fire pay and imminent danger pay for having served in an active combat zone. But if he's considered MIA, all that money flows to his wife, or his, you know, assuming he, you know, Lieutenant Marlowe was, you know, prudent and got all his paperwork together before he deployed. If that status is changed, so if, you know, the Army receives some sort of evidence that he's dead, or after a certain period of time presumes that he's dead, and that presumption can only be made by the Secretary of the Army or a designee, then the pay stops. So I think there's a good chance that she probably got money for a while. I what do you think? I mean, about like when they would have considered him KIA?
You know, it was a big, ugly war, and he was in the Pacific. And we, now granted, he flew a P-51, so he was Air Force. So, but there's lots of little islands, and we lost lots of people. So that doesn't seem like a stretch in a world war, when we're island hopping, that somebody could go down. And the issue is, would they consider him killed in action, or would they consider him MIA? Like, that's the wild card for me.
Yeah. I personally think MIA, because you think about it. So he crashed on Skull Island. Nobody else has penetrated this island until, you know, Samuel Jackson comes in with the cavalry. I mean, he is the cavalry, excuse me. So presumably they would have sent out some limited search party. They did not have the same ability to invest resources to hunt for every pilot that went down. It's a problem that he went down over, you know, technically open water, because, you know, this island is uncharted. So I think the Navy, the military generally would have considered him to have gone down over open water. But his plane is not going to wash up anywhere. So they wouldn't have found any wreckage from him. They wouldn't have found any equipment or gear, certainly not his body. So they wouldn't have had actual evidence of his death. So I think they would have waited a period of time and then declared him dead after a certain point. Whether that's period is shorter because he goes down over open ocean and they just consider him shark bait, so to speak, you know, I don't know. But, you know, at the end of World War II, they had close to 80,000 service members that were considered that were classified missing in action. And it's just an astounding number.
Yeah. It was a big frickin' war over lots of real estate,
yeah,
and open ocean. And like, there were those who got lucky. And you know, Bush won story. It's like, that's an entire another discussion of those who crashed on the island were eaten by their Japanese captors, not because they were hungry, but because they had some really sick views of eating their livers would make them stronger, crazy, crazy behavior. Bush lands in the water, a submarine picks him up. Like, luckiest man in the world. And he was floating for hours. Yeah. We're trying not to end up being shark bait. So it's, I don't know how long they would have been classified. That'd be interesting research. But I'm glad you got to go home, meet his son, and watch the Cubs not get to the World Series till 2016. So
I just have to they had that picture of him. So he at the Super Bowl, he's getting he's in his wheelchair with Barbara by his side, wheeling out. I just have to think, like, when he's looking out on the crowd, like, y'all haven't done nothing. all you pansies.
I bailed out of an aircraft and hit the tail.
Yeah, so, and then I got elected president.
Vice president twice. So
you're sitting there chugging down a 50-ounce Bud Light. Give me a break.
Yeah, don't tell me hard. Which is why he's a national treasure now and everybody loves him. So
that's right.
The America's grandparents. So
that's right.
So
I expect a $10 check for each of my upcoming birthdays from, you know, Bush.
That'd be okay. Which brings us to kind of the end. What did you think of the movie? I mean, did you like it?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I liked the core of it. So I thought the strongest parts were the sort of monster combat. That was just phenomenal. I loved seeing Kong in this sort of period piece. I thought, you know, some little continuity errors aside, I really liked the Vietnam kind of early 70s vibe. Samuel Jackson was absolutely fantastic. Between him and Hank Marlow, John C. Reilly's character, they about stole the show. And, it, you know, in my opinion, they're, you know, some of the other characters were a little bit of, I won't say like flat tires, but they were just sort of like empty vessels. Like Tom Hiddleston, you know, I didn't think he moved the ball a lot. But with those two, you know, Samuel Jackson, John C. Reilly, you know, they carry the boat. And, you know, I would sign me up for a sequel.
I thought it was better than the Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
So that had all kinds of script problems, and you didn't care about any of the characters, and you didn't see Godzilla until like halfway into the movie, and there just wasn't enough monster in it.
Yeah.
And then you have a nuclear bomb going off San Francisco, which there's no way that pilot boat would have gotten out that far. So that should have gone off around the Golden Gate Bridge and been one ugly mess with everyone dying in San Francisco. If it did get off the coast before detonating, everyone would die of lymphoma within like a week. So it's just like that was just wrong on so many levels.
You're keying in on so. I'm so glad that Rogue One turned out as fantastically as I did, but I'm not going to lie. I didn't hate Godzilla, but I totally agree with you. And when they announced that Gareth Edwards was directing Rogue One, I was like, oh, I hope that it's a little bit better than Godzilla, because that one had some issues.
And it was. So, like, this was a solid monster movie all the way through. We had a lot of Kong. They had a lot of other monsters. They didn't try doing two movies at once. It was one survival movie. And I enjoyed it. The characters weren't wooden, like in the Godzilla movie, where you literally didn't care about anyone. Or when you have, you know, the Japanese characters say, the watch was my dad's at Hiroshima. It's like, so you're what, 80? It's like, you don't look that old.
I think the one thing that could have made it, could have brought it in my mind from good to just all time, like fantastic, would have been some stronger supporting characters, even with just Samuel Jackson's soldiers. So if you had had some folks with a little more character to it, I kind of felt like the soldiers were just sort of your stereotypical Vietnam era soldiers, right? They didn't really have much of any feel to them. You had a little bit of development at the end with a couple of them. You know, the one guy that I forget his name, but he, you know, kind of decides that he's going to sacrifice himself for the group and whatnot. You had a little bit of development, but overall they were just kind of tropes to me. And I felt like if it had been sort of like a little more Band of Brothers-y, where you had, you know, some identifiable folks there that people could relate to, that would have made it stronger.
Or like Aliens.
Yeah, that perfect. Yeah, that perfect example.
Yeah, 17 days, we will last 17 hours. Like, you could have...
Maybe you're not up on current events, man. We just got our asses kicked.
That would have made it, you know, like that sort of interaction. Because having interacted with people in the military, they do have personalities.
Yeah.
And so
I'll tell you what, the happiness with which they just went along with this mission, they finished what was presumably a year-long tour in Vietnam of all places. They survive in an air cavalry unit, so that's a feat in and of itself. And then they get tasked, they're presumably ready to get on the boat and go home, and they get tasked to go to some, you know, BS island in the middle of the Pacific, the exact opposite direction. I think they would have been a little pissed. They would have been, I would have liked to see. I was kind of expecting a scene where they're just like, you know, bitching about, you know, this extra mission or whatever. Like I know if I had gotten, you know, tasked at the end of my deployment to like go on something like this, you know, I'd have been a little bent out of shape. They could have played that up a little bit, but
You would think the soldiers would have been like, "No, we're getting the hell out of here now. Like we're not fighting the giant monkey. We are leaving."
Now I'm trying to go get a Coke and a hamburger.
Yeah, it's dude, seriously? Yeah. That was the only like constructive feedback I would have for it, other than it worked. You know, they don't have a forced romantic interest. It's just everybody's kind of normal doing their thing and not wanting to die. And that worked for me.
Yeah. No, I liked it. I think that the best way I can encapsulate, you know, sort of my thoughts on it is I don't buy these days a whole lot of movies when they come out on Blu-ray, DVD. This is what I'm probably going to add to my collection. So that's the best praise that I can give it, you know, on a scale of a rating chain of 0 to 10, probably put it at a 7, 7.5. Good enough to buy for me.
I had friends who put Godzilla at a 7. Mm-hmm. Like, and it was a good, bad movie. I would put this one above it. So it would have to be 7.5 or an 8. Or if Godzilla's a 6, this is a 7.
I'm not going to fight you on that. Yeah, that's fair enough.
It was better. It was better. And maybe that's a good lesson for when you do a monster movie of make it a straight story. Don't try doing everything.
Yeah. Well, I totally agree with you. I think there are folks out there that hate this movie, but Pacific Rim is a decent sort of modern yardstick, right? That movie didn't try to like get too cute with too much stuff. It kind of strayed off in a couple directions, but overall it stayed to exactly what you were there to see, which was a bunch of giant robots beating up a bunch of giant kaiju. So
which at the end of the day makes everybody happy.
Yeah, just remember what folks are there buying tickets and popcorn for, and if you stick to that notion, then you're going to be well served. So,
did you see the end credits scene of the movie
in Skull Island? No, okay. I did not.
So, do you want to know?
Spoil away, yeah, spoil away.
So it ends with Hiddleston and Brie Larson's characters, you know, in the like interrogation room. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's Monarch, and they get the welcome to Monarch. And then they're shown cave drawings that have gods, and it says Kong's not the only king. And they show cave drawings that have Godzilla, Mothra, and King Ghidorah. Or Ghidra, as I knew him in my childhood. So that will be interesting to see what they do. It was a good end credit scene. And it was fun.
Excellent. All the monster movie fans out there are like licking their chops and like greedily rubbing their hands together. So that's good stuff.
It is. Well, that I'm still at the office and need to get home.
Yeah. But, yeah. Well, thanks for inviting me on to talk. This has been a lot of fun.
Yes. And we'll need to talk Star Wars, Clone Wars, and other things. But until then, Absolutely. Thomas, thank you. And America, stay geeky, America.